Dr. Yusuf, we're on.
How's it going?
Great. How are you doing? I just hit record, so you're aware.
All right. Sounds good. I just finished the day. All good?
It's great to finally talk with you in person. I never got to meet you in person yet.
Well, hopefully soon, man. You're going to be a neighbor.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll be in Melville.
Pleasure meeting you over Zoom or whatever this platform is, but looking forward to meeting one day.
Man. Pleasure's all mine.
You're going to work for one of our brethren.
That's right. Dr. Chavkin, you know him.
Yes, he's one of the county guys. County guys.
Give me one second. My fan's a little loud. There we go. I got a corner room, and it's very hot in here today because the sun was beaming on it, but I got the fan on. It was just blowing my ear, but I can hear you a little bit better now.
Sounds good. I can't wait to feel the heat and go outside. I've been locked indoors all day, but...
Yeah, it got hot. It got hot out there, man.
It's always too hot or too cold, right? There's always complaints. In residency, kind of stuck with me. I was in general surgery, and I was operating with this breast surgeon. And he says, you know, we're raising the flaps for mastectomies, and too thin, too thick. You're going too thick. You're going too thin. And at some point, I forgot, it wasn't me or one of my, somebody with me says, all right, how do you want the flaps today? You want them too thin or you want them too thick today? So same with weather. It's always either too hot or too cold. There's always complaints.
Yeah, the sun's too thick today, you know?
It's too thick, exactly.
How was the day? How'd the day go?
Day was good, other than, so I had full arch cases scheduled back-to-back today and tomorrow, other than finding out that tomorrow's guy got sick.
Oh, no.
To cancel, today was good. Today's case went well, all good, whole bunch of consults, follow-ups this afternoon. Finished a little bit early, so that's always good.
That's always great. Yeah.
No complaints for a Monday.
Today was a maxilla or a mandible?
Surprisingly, there's more maxillas being done. You just had to, and you would think that if you kind of think about it, financial limitations there, right, on full arch immediate load,
right?
And I think maxilla is more aesthetic. So it'll take a whole bunch of people. They'll probably choose to do maxillas over mandibles at some point. So I think statistically speaking, ultimately people do more maxillas, because I'm sure there's a whole bunch of mandibles that need to be done just sitting around, you know, under nice maxillas somewhere. So it's just, I think, financial selection, financially driven case selection kind of thing.
Right. Unfortunately,
This is not like studied back though. This is just my opinion. So
yeah,
but I definitely feel there's more maxillas being done. Maybe something to look into.
That is interesting.
Maybe something to look into, and you know, a little epidemiology of full arch implant dentistry. I'm sure this will yield some cool results.
Oh, that's a really good idea. That's something to look into, yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of which, if you told me during my training I'll be doing immediate load full arch implants, I'd probably laugh at you back then.
Really? Why is that?
I was in a dual degree program at Kings County.
Yep.
Very trauma heavy. I don't know if you know history of Kings County program in the past couple of decades. A significant amount, I can't say the amount off the top of my head, but a significant amount of head neck surgeons came out of Kings County Oral Surgery Program. Again, another opinion of mine, you know, this is not backed up or anything, but I think Kings County gives you this exposure to a lot of non-dental alveolar surgery. There's a lot of trauma, it's busy, you're always operating, but you kind of get close to it, but not really doing the real oncologic stuff. At least back then, when I was in training, that's how it was. So it's almost, I think, a tease. And then a lot of, residents end up going to head neck. And if you look at it, it's actually my opinion, I think there's been a paradigm shift in oral surgery. During my days, it was a hot thing to do. Everybody wanted to do head neck. Now a lot of programs have head neck components.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, more and more programs, if not probably majority of programs, now have at least one attending who would be doing oncology. And now I hear residents complaining. This is not what I signed up for. Why do I need to do this big stuff? I need to be doing more sedations. So there's been like a 180 degree turn.
Yeah.
In my days, we were kept saying, hey, we're not doing surgery big enough. We want to do bigger stuff. You know, we do enough teeth. We do enough implants. Forget this stuff. Let's do the big wax. And now things have changed, I think. So I don't know. Again, this is my opinion, but I think your exposure kind of molds your desires a little bit.
Yeah.
So again, just
it's definitely true. Here at my program, I've done more cancer this year than I've done orthognathics, which is crazy, but it's the truth. So much exposure to cancer, Really cool operations, though, between, I mean, everything that we're doing.
For neck, sure.
Neckolectomies, maxillectomies, glossectomies, reconstruction of lips using different, you know, different incision patterns and techniques. It's fun, aesthetic. I'm never going to do them again. I'm not going to be a cancer guy, but yeah.
But I always tell my residents, even if you're not going to ever do them again, it molds you. It gives you a training that you will use for things you are going to do.
Right.
You know, doing a neck dissection that you'll never, ever do again makes you a better oral surgeon that will do an extraoral mandible.
Mm.
You're a better surgeon that will go and do an extraoral IND. Those things you will do. Hopefully. Most people end up doing some of those things in private practice.
That's
even
true.
Maybe you're not going to do it on a monthly basis, but, you know, take call once a year, you know, an infection comes in and you got to go and drain them extraorally.
Right.
Having done neck dissections in residency will help you. Even at this point, you probably have done enough trachs that are associated with those head neck cases, where if, God forbid, you have an airway case, you will be more prepared to do a trach. You will be more prepared to manage an airway better than if you've never done head neck.
That's a good point.
It's a big blessing. It's a big blessing to our field, to our specialty, to have more and more head neck guys, even if most residents are not going to do it. I think it just makes you a better surgeon overall.
I really agree with that, making you a better surgeon. The one concern I have for it is, you know, in between dental alveolar and towards head and neck, a lot of the hospitals pull residents towards the medical side of the residency, the health, you know, the general surgery side. And a lot of the head and neck is tied in with that. But it's pulling us away from the dental school, the clinic, the VA, where you get to work with a lot of the other specialties. So then where do those quote unquote, you know, traditionally smaller cases, oral surgery procedures, where do they go? You're seeing a lot of them get sent to perio now. And, you know, some students graduate, especially over here. I don't want to name schools or institutions, but a lot of students graduate. They don't even realize oral surgeons place implants. They're referring everything. It's like protocol now at dental schools to refer all the implants to perio. Another thing I'm noticing is these perio residencies are increasing the resident spots at a faster rate than oral surgery residencies are increasing resident spots. This is a problem. Now, there's the oral surgery residencies are increasing non-categorical intern spots. Great. That's an extra hand. You know, it gives them some experience. But that's not a resident. That's not a full matriculated residence for 4 to 6 years. And I'm just concerned because we should be taking everything as oral surgeons, not just selective here and there. It's what you went through. It's everything. But I'm noticing more and more certain attendings are like, no, I don't want to do any implants, or no, I don't want to do any head neck, everything, you know?
Yeah. It's a valid concern. Again, when I was in training, we had those concerns with the bigger stuff. I think what comes into play, what's super important here with this point, is mentorship. And I think once you're in practice, you will have a mentor, and it depends. So the analogy I make is you're learning the ABCs in residency. You're going to read books in practice. Right. So it's all the basics. One line that I get from my mentor, from, you know, my first boss, mentor, part, you know, surgical partner, Dr. David Hoffman.
Hoffman,
He trained in Parkland in the 80s. And it was kind of mind boggling when I spoke to him about it. He says he's done a handful, and he's not being sarcastic. He says, I've done a handful of full bony set of four wisdom teeth extractions in my entire residency. And he means it. This, you know, that in those days, Parkland was the orthognathic surgery.
Right.
And look at him now. He's in extended scope practice, doing TMJ, doing cleft, doing implants. I learned full arch implant, you know, AOX from him.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, his line was 90% of what I do today, I did not do in residency.
Mm-hmm. Right after.
Well, you know, as a resident, I felt the same. I relate. Was a little, you know, other, you know, end of the spectrum, but I felt the same. I think that you'll be fine. You're in for something good. I think you have an amazing career in front of you, and it all depends what you want to do. If you want to do, and you're more interested in dental alveolar, I mean, you have the guy for it. You have the mentor.
That's,
you know,
I got lucky there.
Any, you know, any better mentor than, you know, Chafkin? This is the guy who probably complained in his residency that he did too much dental alveolar. You know, so again, if you were graduating and wanting to pursue a career and head neck and said, you know, I did a ton of it, but I still need more. Again, same thing. I think proper mentors is what you need.
That's a great point.
We all complain during training. I think it's just not in that natural. You know, we complain about call. We complain about being too busy. People complain about not having enough of a certain procedure, but you'll be fine.
You know? What are you complaining about these days? I'm curious. As a private practice owner, you're a full-on oral surgeon. You did all the degrees.
Tell me what I complain about.
Yeah.
The line that I use when I complain is the easiest thing you do is surgery. Private practice life. You reach a point where surgery becomes something you do every day. You know, case after case after case after case, numbers start getting there. And, you know, the hard part is putting the patient on the table. Once the patient is on the operating room table, that's when the fun part starts.
Right, right.
Outside of the operating room is the outside. It's, you know, and again, I'm a mix of, you know, extended scope, full scope practice and private practice. So, you know, you name it, you know, dealing with patient flow into the practice, right? Dealing with business aspect of hiring staff, managing staff, you know, staff complaints every day, you know, getting insurance authorizations for the hospital, getting OR time at the desired time, having the proper instruments that you want. You know, I could do 3 free flap, you know, head neck cases back to back in a matter of, you know, a month. And on the third one, the staff is great. They know the trays to open. They know what instruments we need. They know what the microscope is, the couplers are.
Right.
And then you have a hiatus for, you know, 4 or 5 weeks and you don't do any of those cases in that hospital. And you come back and it's a shit show. Nobody knows what, you know, where everything goes and nothing's ready. Nothing's open. So that's the hard part in private practice. That's, you know, and I always kind of say, you know, I have a young associate, very talented guy, Dr. Greg Yunov. I was telling him, you know, your first year in practice will be the hardest year.
I think from your perspective, yeah.
More difficult than a residency. I think you'll probably work the hardest. You'll be stressed the most. And that's the year, I think, that will mold a lot of things and mold you into, you know, you kind of figuring out what you want to do, where you want to be. And that's why I always say, I think your first associateship, your first job is probably one of the most important things that you're going to do, and it's going to mold a lot of your future. Again, some people choose not the best first job. Maybe, you know, I'm not going to say it, but probably use the word, they make a mistake choosing their first job. That's not what they intended for themselves. And it's fine. It's fixable. They go and move on. You hear people work, you know, had an associateship for a year and then moved on. Fine. It's all fixable. But I think, you know, as important as schooling is, as important as residency is, I think your first couple years are very formative years being an associate. And I think it's good to be an associate. Some people go and open a practice right away. It's definitely cool. I know people that have done it. I just think it's probably more prudent to be an associate for the first couple years. And I think it's important to look at who you're working for.
Right.
Your surgical partner, boss, mentor should be a mentor. And that person should be somebody that you kind of see yourself being fast forward by however many, many years. And I got lucky like that. My first associateship was Staten Island, Dr. David Hoffman. Still practicing at 75, going strong, you know, double jaws, joints, and full arch. And I was lucky. He was my first true mentor. And, very grateful to having worked for him, alongside him. And again, you know, we had residents rotate. I don't know if you know how King Scan program works, but Staten and I met him as a resident, and residents rotate in his office. His office is in the hospital.
Oh.
Right. So it's a rotation site. It's a private practice that physically is in the hospital, Staten Island University. So you could walk down a flight of stairs and you're in the ambulatory surgical center, and you could walk over a bridge in the winter when it's, you know, cold, you don't have to put a jacket on, and you're in the main hospital. You could be in the ICU in like 3 minutes. So it's a very unique place, and I was very lucky to have him as my mentor. And cannot mention my other surgical partner, Lydia Lam, who's currently a partner of his. So it was 3 of us when I was there, and it was a great experience. Yeah, and I always, you know, a lot of residents and a lot of other surgeons will say, oh, you know, with this macho, I don't need help. And, you know, I'll say it, listen, you need a mentor. Has Dr. Hoffman ever needed to come into my operating room or into my, you know, operatory office and needed to, like, bail me out? Well, what hasn't happened. But having that, you know, knowledge that he's there if I needed him to, and just like bouncing ideas off somebody, and even Lydia, she's more of a peer, but she was still somewhat of a mentor to me, you know, in those days. And just having somebody, you know, just bounce ideas off and run things by is just invaluable.
That's so important. Yeah.
Super important. Yeah. And you're going to be in a group with multiple people. I mean, you know, that's our specialty, you know, never, you know, have an ego, feel bad to say, you know, hey, Jeff, can look at this case. What do you think, man? Like, you know, take away. How do you think I should do this? How do you think I should approach this implant case or whatever it is? Nah, you'll get good advice. You always will, you know, get good advice. And don't hesitate, you know, reach out to, you know, people outside your practice too, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You'll reach out. That's, you know, good thing about our specialty, you know, we have that camaraderie that, you know, we could be practicing next door to each other, you know, and competitions, but we're colleagues above competitors. It's
right.
Always, you know, it's always the case, and we're friends above competitors, and never hesitate, you know, to reach out for help, for all our stuff, or, you know, anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I like how close knit most of the oral surgeons are. Yeah, that's a good point. And the mentorship, I was in between Jason Auerbach actually, or Dr. Chavkin, Ross Chavkin. And I liked Chavkin's office. It's closer to my family at home. And he seems to be a good mentor. He's always on top of the game. He's very active. Yeah. I'm excited
for next year. Really active in training. I think they're both county guys. I'm pretty sure they're fairly close friends. Pretty close friends, I would say. They overlap. I'm not wrong. So us being county guys, I did not overlap with them. They're a little bit, you know, the old farts compared to me.
Yeah.
So I think they were like pretty close, maybe a year or two apart. But yeah, definitely both solid guys, both going to be good mentors to their younger docs, and
right.
Definitely solid dental alveolar practices. A lot to learn in terms of clinical practice for you, a lot to learn in terms of practice management. Patient management, billing.
What were some of the things that like the first things that you didn't expect when you started private practice? Because you were saying the surgery is the easy part. I'm curious, like what's the hardest, the thing that gets you in a bind sometimes?
So you won't feel that way on your first day.
Mm.
I mean, the surgery becoming easy, I think it's a gradual progression. Every now and then there's a wisdom tooth case that will kick my ass. I mean, that happens. But, you know, as you start seeing patients, I think it's an emotional roller coaster. It depends on your approach. My approach was when I started, it wasn't like a, you know, I'll bring a DSO into an example. It was like a DSO facility where I was the 9-to-5, and what I was going to be on my schedule is going to be my schedule. I was in a practice where I needed to build my practice. I needed
right.
to go out. And, you know, I usually talk, I use the term when I talk to, you know, younger docs, everybody could do 9-to-5. It's those that could do 5-to-9, that's hard. So there was a 5-to-9 pressure, you know, and you start seeing patients and there's some overflow. You got some patients on your schedule, but, you know, schedule's empty. And you get like that, you know, type A surgeon personality. I need to go get and fill my schedule. You know, it's kind of, you know, I got to go and do something about it, you know, rather than sitting and just, you know, browsing online or something. You sit there and you're anxious and you say, so, you know, it's an emotional roller coaster. You'll get those, you know, you'll pressure yourself. It depends on, you know, your expectations of yourself. I have high and I was, you know, feeling a little anxious and saying to myself, what do I need to do? And you get up, you start doing something that you're probably not going to like. You got to go and knock on doors and buy cookies and, you know, do all that good stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and then you get called, you get an emergency in the chair while you're like somewhere picking up food. It gets, you know, interesting. So
knocking on doors
is interesting and you're figuring things out. I mean, things are different from residency. Oh, you see somebody in clinic at Bellevue, you guys, I'm sure, have somebody's like, hey, you know, let's get this case into the OR. You know, you do a lot of legwork, of course, but there's still, you know, certain infrastructure. You know, when you came into the program, there was a guy before you who booked cases, and he'll tell you this is how you book cases.
Right, right.
You know, you're going to come to private practice now and decide to take a patient to the operating room and, you know, go to the office manager and say, what's operating? What are you talking about? You know, so, you know, you got to figure that out. You know, how do you get authorizations? Which CPT code was ICD-10? Right. You know, in the beginning, it could get intense. You get intense, you know, and then you're seeing dentists, you whining and dining, you're going, you know, dinners, you get tired. Next thing you know, you got an OR case the next day, you got to wake up early. And then, you know, it's all overall at the end of the day, it's all good stuff. It's all good problems, you know.
Yeah.
But it's hectic, it's stressful, it's emotional. But after first year, I think you're kind of, okay, now I know what's up. Now I know where the bathroom is. Now I know my schedule. Now I know where I belong on the Monday. Now I know where I belong on the Wednesday, and you kind of, you know, start building. And listen, it's exciting, man. It's exciting times for you. Chief year, end of chief year is like senioritis. You know,
a little bit.
Good. The weather's getting good. You know, it's sunny outside.
Yeah, it's getting good.
And enjoy it. Definitely enjoy it. Take a nice trip. It's probably the last time you're going to have like a month. Over a month.
True.
I'm off. I don't think you'll have that. God knows how long. Decade, probably.
That's a good point. Yeah, probably never again, right? Are you going to be taking any trips anytime soon?
I take trips, but I don't take trips that are month long.
For like month, yeah.
I take trips. It's funny. Like this year, I had trips every single month this year. So, you know, I had a personal vacation in January. We went skiing. Then a lot of work trips. A lot of work trips. I was in Guatemala with Orca.
Nice. Nice.
March. I think March I stayed put, but April I'm going to my colleague, buddy at Williams this weekend. We'll hang out in Texas, in Dallas.
Oh, in Dallas. Very nice. Yeah.
Yeah. The Join a Day King.
Who is it?
Fayette Williams.
Williams. Okay. I'm sure I recognize the face. Yeah.
Fayette Williams and Roger Kim and those guys. Dan Hammer is probably going to be in the course. I'm going down there to, you know, spend some time. Those guys are rock stars in the head neck world. Head, neck, and implants world. You live and learn. Oh, I actually gave a talk at Orca Symposium on dental implants and free flat, and mainly fibula. It's the workhorse.
Oh.
Like, I am going to attending a course, one of my colleagues, on the same topic. You live, you learn, right? You live, you learn.
That's great. That's great, though. Yeah, and you're giving support to them. They're your colleagues. You know them. No, that's a great way. You got to keep learning. It's always constant learning.
Definitely. And some of my friends tell me, it's like, Doc, you do this, you know, you really got to go take a course in this. I'm like, yeah, I want to see how they do it. You know, they do it more than me, and I'm sure I'll pick up some tricks that they learn on their mistakes.
Right, right.
So there's definitely, you know, benefit in seeing how other people do it.
Yeah, and that's a great point you just made. The best attendings, at least I like to that be, they're the ones that tell you their mistakes. They say, if you do this, it'll result in this. And I want to prevent you from letting that happening. So do it this way because of this. I think the people that expose their mistakes are the best teachers.
For sure. That is definitely true. And I think complications is our tuition money, or tuition for learning. Complications, depends how you approach it. Complications could certainly elicit a lot of anxiety.
Yeah.
Surgeon. But if you put that aside and say to yourself, I'm going to deal with it. And I'm going to learn from it, and I'm going to see what I did that caused it so that I don't do that next time, or I do something different. And it's going to overall be a net positive, because you're taking something out of it. You know, we're not in it for one patient. We're not in it for one case. We're in it for the long run. If you had one implant that failed, hopefully the next 10,000 that you do will reflect the learning point that you had on that one implant that failed.
10,000. That's a good number.
Right. So listen, you'll reach it. You'll reach it. It sounds like an insane amount, but after a couple of years of practice, you'll see how, you know, especially now with the full arch implants being a thing, you could do a single case and have 12 implants in, you know, in a couple hours and be 12 implants in. You know, it may, you know, take oral surgeons in the past way longer to do 12 single implants. You know, it might take, you know, a week or so. Now you could get 12 implants in on a single patient. Yeah, and that's essentially your routine now. Yeah, but numbers is numbers, you know, numbers. You stop counting at some point.
Right. You got to stop counting at some point. I love the full arch cases. Yeah.
You count for the inventory so that your staff orders the sizes in time. That's what you count these days. So you don't have, you know, you don't have the 4, 5, 15 missing when you need it.
Hey, you know, your post that you just got up, we were chatting about this before we came on. We were talking about that. It was a podcast episode clip that you had done, and we're talking about a generation that doesn't want to work as hard for it, or doesn't work as hard for it, or doesn't know, isn't as hungry as possibly they were in the past. I think that's such a good point. And we weren't necessarily talking about like, they're just not as hungry, but it's the day's different. What was your insight on that to start off?
It was a shorter clip out of obviously like an hour long podcast. And It's a good point. What we were talking about, so it's a podcast by it's a non-dental podcast by one of our community members. I come from a fairly small community. I'm a Bukharian Jewish former Soviet Union. I'm from Uzbekistan, so it's a very small community of Jews from Soviet Union, mainly from the southern part. It's a Muslim country, so it was a Jewish population living in a Muslim country. Immigrated to America, and now mostly kind of concentrated in Queens. So it was a podcast by community members who were talking about us. I was 14 years old when I moved to this country, so my kids were obviously born here. So that was the point I was bringing up. The drive that we had, my generation, is not necessarily the same as my kids will have. They do take some things for granted. This is not to say that the younger generation is not as hardworking. And if you kind of translate this point just outside of our community, just in general in the United States, I don't think the younger generation is not as hardworking. I think it's just the world is different. Perception is different. Also, like when I was in high school, some of my friends said, you know what? You know, and it depends on the family, right? Some, you know, some families raise kids and say, you know what, I'm a doctor, your mom's a doctor, you know, you got to be a doctor or you got to be a dentist or whatever. That's, you know, pressure. So, you know, we had kids that wanted to be doctors, we had kids that wanted to be lawyers, but then there were some that said, you know, I'm going to work hard. I'm going to be a construction man. I'm going to make money. Or, you know, I had friends who said, you know what, I'm going to go to sanitation. They get great benefits. Mm-hmm. You know, like you hear younger kids talk now. And again, I'm not saying they're lazy, but the world is different. Now you hear 18-year-olds talking about investing in Bitcoin and startups and futures and talking about that. I listened to Patrick Bet-David podcast and he was talking about it the other day. And he said, you know, this 18-year-old kid asked him, he's like, which of these should I do? And BBD asked him, says, well, how much money you made in this past year? And says, well, I made $10,000. Says, well, first focus on your cash flow before you're focusing about investments. So I think the mentality is different. You know, and I think that reflects a little bit on us now running our practices. Mm-hmm. So when we go out there and try to recruit staff members, most young people these days, they have some kind of business ideas in mind. You know, it's generally neural surgery is just a general kind of thing where most assistants are females just because of, you know, male doing a sedation. So you want assistants being females just in general. That's a general kind of thing in neural surgery. So a lot of females now are not looking for a permanent job. You know, you get a, you know, a young female in her mid-20s applying for a neural surgery position, but her reality is she's starting a makeup business.
Yeah.
She has an Instagram with a certain following and she's building this, you know, esthetician business and she needs some cash flow temporarily. So she's picking up a job and that has impact on us because you hire somebody, you train them, you know, and now with all the technology, you train somebody how to take, you know, in the old days, you had to train them how to process film. Now we have to train them how to take CBCTs, how to take intraoral scan, how to run a 3D printer, how to characterize a printed template, you know, how to assist in anesthesia. You train them all those things and you spend about, my average has been about 3 months is when they become independent. So you you know, you get a dental assistant, you know, and you spend 3 months, worked in dentistry before, you spend 3 months adapting them to oral surgery, and now they move on to their makeup business or whatever it is. So that's the impact that it has on us a little bit. So I think, you know, look, is it a bad change? Is it a lazy generation? No, I don't think it's lazy. It's just different. It's just different from when we were growing up.
Right. So many options. They have so many options at their fingertips now. And I mean, we all see it. Yeah, it's a great point. It's very different. And that the turnover is going to be a lot higher too. That's a good point, right? Because they come in, you train them for 3 months, and then they're gone in 6 months later after that. And then you got to retrain the next person. It's a strain on the practice. Instant gratification.
It's investment of your time and resources. And being a revolving door of a practice, it's just not the way to go. That's what I try to avoid.
Mm.
Knock on wood. Thank God, very lucky. I had amazing staff. You know, we're about 15, right? I am a startup, by the way. You know, I don't know if you kind of followed my, you know, when I left Staten Island, I came to Long Island and it was a completely startup from scratch. It's going to be 3 years this June. So we have a staff of 15. I mean, now we grew and I'm very lucky. Every single one of, you know, one of those 15 people, every single one of them is just superb. you know. And
congratulations, by the way. I mean, that's very difficult to do, especially in this day and age, among all the other issues that you mentioned. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. No, I've certainly been blessed and lucky. I mean, there's a component of hard work, and you put out what you need to put out. But sometimes a thought comes to mind. If I imagine doing all that and not getting busy and not getting successful. So there's definitely a component of, call it luck, call it from something from above. But, you know, I've definitely been blessed. You know, I've done my part, but I certainly know people that have done their part and they still struggle. So definitely we're in a good place for being a young practice. Mm-hmm. Long Island is notorious for having dinosaur practices. Long Island is not, especially with oral surgery, Long Island hasn't had that many startups. You know, we haven't had too many oral surgeons. And in my journey during my startup, I've met some dentists who laughed in my face or looked at me like, what are you thinking? I had guys who told me like, what are you thinking? What are you doing? Do you even understand what you're doing? Because it's an established community. There's been oral surgery practices that have been here for decades. And the dentists have been here for a long time. And they have their referral patterns that are pretty established. And obviously, you know, we proved them wrong in a way.
Yeah.
And we're continuing to do so. I always say, like I said earlier, all friends and colleagues, we compete by providing the best patient care we provide. You know, we don't compete by stealing patients or saying bad things about each other. You know, at the end of the day, we'll back each other up. And if one of my neighbor or surgeons has a complication when they're out of town, we'll treat those patients like our own. But like, how do we get ahead? We do the work, you know, we
treat work
well, we make sure our patients are happy. Dentists like to be proud when they refer a patient to you.
Mm.
You know, if a dentist refers a patient to me and the patient comes back raving about you, that dentist will be proud. It's a positive reinforcement. They'll want to send to you more. So that's the key, you know, do good work and there's enough for everyone.
That's right.
For everyone. There's enough patients. Do good work. Be a good, you know, addition to dental community. Be a good addition to whatever local community at. And I think you'll do well, you know, put in time. And like I said, there's enough for everyone.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, there's plenty out there, especially Long Island. What's the population's what, like 2.5 million people on Long Island or something? It's huge. Very populated.
I think Long Island's underrated. When people think of Long Island, they think of these dead suburbs, but Long Island is a very bustling suburb.
Oh, yeah.
Long Island is big and well-populated, and there's a lot of cool stuff on the island.
There is. You know, it's not just, what, the Long Island douchebag, they call it. There is that, but it's not just that. You got the Hamptons, you got the beaches, you got the North Shore, you got good restaurants. There's a lot of good stuff. You got the wineries out east. Oh, there's a lot of fun.
There's cool stuff here. You know, it depends. You know, if you're a foodie, you'll say, you know, you got to go to the city to get some. But I have a very close friend who's a foodie. I prove him wrong all the time. There's a lot of good restaurants. You can't stay on the island every Saturday night, but right. you could certainly skip those trips to the city at least once or twice a month. There's definitely stuff to do here.
What's your favorite restaurant? What's your go-to spot on the island, if anyone comes to mind?
I mean, in terms of type of food, I'm a sushi guy. I love sushi.
Okay.
And one of my spots, not because they have the best sushi, but, you know, it's a nice spot to go and have a drink, and it's a nice vibe. I go to Toku. It's around the corner from the office. I could be there in 5 minutes.
Oh, it's right near you then. Okay.
It's right near me. I mean, there are restaurants that are closer to me. I'm walking distance to Kima, which is a... So Roslyn is very restaurant heavy. So
yeah.
I'm working to Kima. We have Hendrix. We actually do some of our study clubs at Hendrix. Our last study club at Limani, which is a great Greek spot. So yeah, there's like so many choices around me. But Toku is one of my more common ones because you go in, you know, there's always people at the bar. You know, if you like stumble in, you could always chit chat with somebody. Food is good. I'm not saying bad sushi. I'm not saying it's not the best sushi, but they definitely have good food overall. For a sushi spot, they definitely have good hot food. But if you want to try something new, if you want to try something exotic or for nice omakase, you're definitely making a trip to the city.
Yeah. Speaking of, did Chavkin take you to Fly Fish Club?
Chavkin has not. Maybe Chavkin should listen to this podcast and take me to Fly Fish Club.
Or maybe I can. Maybe I could take you there.
I haven't been to Fly Fish Club yet, but I'm not a member, but I have been several times to ZZ's. It's great. And
yeah.
I know some of your other friends are ZZ's members. I know that I see Arbeck post about it, and I'm pretty sure he's a member. I'm not, but I have a close friend who is.
That's all you need.
Yeah. One day. But yeah, fly fish is like the new hot spot.
It is. When do you want to come through? When do you want to go?
We'll set a date. We'll hang out.
We're going to see if they got any openings tonight. I'm sure you're busy. That would be awesome if we could swing by like that. I have the NFT, so I could get the omakase. I can only book 7 days out, but yeah, wow. I could book a restaurant spot. Maybe we could get trafficking in there too. That'd be fun.
That'd be nice little reunion. Yeah, that'd be nice reunion. Yeah, that'd be so cool. We'll talk. we'll talk off record. We'll pick a date.
Yeah. We'll have to do that. But awesome. What other stuff you got coming up this week? Any other? You mentioned the Full Arch tomorrow canceled. Patient got sick. That's too bad.
Patient got sick, but you know, like sounds like a URI. Should bounce back. Should be fine. Gives me a chance to hit the gym and catch up with some admin stuff at the office after, and then my afternoon's still full, so that.
How often, so you said, what, 10 years ago, or when you were in residency, you'd never think of be doing full arch cases. How often are you getting full arch cases in? If you almost said two this week, three this week.
So we're doing about 8 to 10 a month arches.
Oh man.
It's a whole different world. A full arch implant dentistry is like a whole subspecialty of dentistry.
Oh, yeah.
Not just oral surgery, but dentistry. I'm actually giving a talk to Nassau County Dental Society in April, April 10th. I'm actually giving a talk on AOX. But I've been involved in it, not by choice. Like when I was a chief resident, I thought it was cool. I was probably the first chief resident at Kings County. I did a double arch immediate load conversion. This was back in 2015, 10 years ago. I don't think I was a chief. I mean, I might have been a senior. But I just had that interest. I thought it was always cool. But you know how you verbally say to yourself, this is what I want to do?
Mm.
Full arch implantology was not one of the things that I thought I would be doing a lot of. My training was in, trauma, orthognathics, full scope oral surgery during my Kings County days. I trained with an ENT surgeon in head neck oncology. It was a full scope of head neck with the endocrine surgery, oral cavity, During training, I was essentially like an orphan child under ENT. I was disconnected from dentistry altogether. Second time in my training, like general surgery being the first full year. I mean, if somebody told me you'll be doing prosthetics, like sometimes, you need to do occlusal rims to establish a proper VDO. If somebody told me I would be doing that as a surgeon or I'll be doing occlusal adjustments, I would have laughed. Fortunately or unfortunately, this goes, kind of as a package deal. You can't be a full arch surgeon and not know how to do prosthetics. And initially when we started doing this, we started this as a very classic oral surgeon GP relationship. Mm. We would see these patients for a consultation. Patient needed a full arch. I wouldn't dare to touch that patient before they saw a general dentist. So we would either communicate with the dentist that referred that patient or refer that patient to a general dentist, have a consultation, and that's how we did it. And then we realized very quickly that wasn't a system that was going to work.
No, what do you mean?
Full arch is new. Full arch is a lot of times new way of thinking. There are still dentists out there who you could show them a case that is certainly a full arch case in many of my colleagues or my friends' offices. Mm-hmm. But there are dentists who would say, no, this is an SRP. This tooth has a grade 2 mobility. We could send them to a periodontist for arrestin. We could do a root canal here. We could retreat this molar and we could redo this crown. And we could do a bridge here. And we could do a sinus lift on the left. And in my circle with full arch, with the Orca guys especially, will say they'll do $200,000 in 2 years of dentistry to rehabilitate them. And they still have mouthful of teeth that will fail in near future. History tends to repeat itself. Is it wrong to do that? It's not wrong to do that. But as we talked earlier, the world has changed and the people have changed with it. Patients don't want it. A lot of patients don't want it. And it's our job to educate. I'm not one of those guys who blindly, like some corporate offices these days, that blindly just tell them you need full arch. I truly tell my patients, we could do conventional dentistry on you. And I've done several cases in the past 6 months where I have like moderate perio canine to canine, and I'm doing bilateral sinus lifts and implants and, subsequently you know, stage restoration. Do I think those should have been full arches? Absolutely. Those patients elected to do it conventional way. And sometimes we'll do it the conventional way. But back to the workflow, where a lot of these patients would come in and we would do the classic going for a general dentist consult, kind of, you know, oral surgeon of general dentist relationship. A lot of those patients were set on full arch. And we knew that they were set on full arch, and we knew that they were well educated because we've done the initial consult. And they would go see the dentist, and not to say anything negative about the dentist, but a lot of dentists didn't know how to do a full arch. And all of us, me and myself included, prosthodontists have accomplished this. They've sent this message that full arch rehab is very difficult. Hmm. That was the prosthodontist's message to every dental student and every dental school.
Yeah, yeah.
And these dentists that are practicing, like, you know, inner city dentistry, you know, doing root canals, doing whatever, filling some implants, you know, single unit, an occasional denture, they get a patient in their door that needs a full arch rehab, the prosthodontic bells go off. I'm going to need to index and do open tray impressions and establish vertical. And like, this is not something they do every day. And all these, you know, alarm bells go off and like, this is a hard case.
Right.
And some people get scared and talk those patients out of it and say, you know what, I'll send you to my periodontist. Some dentists get scared, and their response was scaring them with fees. They will, you know, name this insane amount. Yeah, I'll restore this for $25,000. And now we realize that this is inefficient, and patients are now blocked. So how do you tell now? How do you tell this patient that dentist was wrong when you send them? You know, I refer them to this dentist, and now dentist essentially talked them out of doing full arch. And now how do I tell them? You know, that guy was wrong. We kind of realized that we need to be a captain of the ship and now get behind the prosthetic wheel in addition to behind the surgical wheel. And if you don't know prosthetics, you're not going to basically be a full arch center. You're not going to do this at Valley. Because I'm at a point where I need to hold the dentist's hand throughout the restorative phase of full arch.
Wow. Yeah.
And, you know, and it's like we do it twice, we do it three times with the new dentist. New dentist to full arch, and they realize how they could do this, how straightforward it is. You know, I joke around and I say, you know, what's prosthodontics about? You know, we talk about occlusion and vertical dimension. Oral surgeons learn all this. When you approach your orthognathic cases, you know what vertical dimension is. Mm-hmm. You know what occlusal plane is. You could do all that. What you're lacking as a surgical prosthodontist is ability to take impressions. If I had to do open tray impression and index implants, I wouldn't be able to do it. So what makes us prosthodontists, in quotes, is digital dentistry.
Right.
With photogrammetry, with intraoral scanning, I don't need open tray impressions. I don't need indexing implants. But having our training in full in orthognathics, I could establish the VDO. I could tell my lab, make me a set of occlusal rims based on the intraoral scan. I don't know alginate in my office. They send me, you know, not every case needs it, but they send me a set of occlusal rims. You know a patient's jaw goes better than any other dental specialty. Tell me a dental specialty that takes a mobile maxilla and a mobile mandible and puts it where they belong.
Yeah.
So you basically do that with occlusal rims. You establish their aesthetics. You establish their phonetics. You send it back to lab. They digitize it. And you go, you execute your surgery. And then you have your prosthetics. I mean, I'm summarizing. I'm giving you cliff notes a little bit.
No, that's a good point, yeah.
But basically, we realized that we need to sit behind a prosthetic wheel and take charge. So that's a big part of being a full arch. And what we'll do is we'll do the surgery, we'll get rid of bad teeth, you know, obviously keep the patient comfortable under the anesthesia, place the implants in correct position. Now that you're in charge, knowing that you're going to temporize, now you're paying more attention to your implants, but you essentially, by the time you're done with the patient, they have their implants in and they intemperate. They have their vertical dimension, they have their midline, they have their occlusal plane. We let the implants integrate, and that's when I repeat my digital records, which is essentially the final impression. So now the dentist gets this patient with their first try in a little white lab bag. So what they got to do now is work out the aesthetics. Do you like a different color? You know, maybe make the incisor a little longer, make it more aesthetic, maybe fill the buccal corridors a little more. But the ballpark is there. You know, the patient has appropriate vertical, appropriate midline, appropriate occlusal plane. So they refine their aesthetics by communicating with the lab, with the designer, and they go into another try-in. They unscrew the prototype I have in. They put in the new prototype. patient approves it, they process it, and whatever material they decide. These days, zirconia, you know, a monolithic zirconia being the workhorse. And patient got their teeth in a single sitting, because I consider them having the prototype in at the time of surgery. They have teeth in.
Yeah.
They could smile. They have aesthetic, you know, smile. You know, they have nice set of teeth that don't come out. It's not a denture. So I think the clock starts ticking at that point. So patient right. got teeth at the time of surgery. It truly is teeth in a day. So again, tell me I've been doing this during training, but you know, I would have laughed. But this is, you know, I think, you know, we're able to help patients. You know, we get this done in one sitting. We forget about our anxious population, right? A lot of people physically, even if they had the money for it, cannot go through that 2-year conventional full mouth rehab.
Right. So
people's anxiety just won't allow you. And what was the term used about the Long Island, bro? There's a lot of
douchebag.
The Long Island bro fast forward into their 60s.
Yeah.
So the construction worker that smokes and like, you know, you can't reason with them. What, you know, there's a missed canal. You got to go see an endodontist to retreat it.
Oh,
well, go tell this to, you know, a big, you know, construction worker guy from Suffolk. Like, they're not going to go with that. They're a perfect candidate. You know, they haven't taken care of their teeth. They're a perfect candidate for Forge. You know, they get this done in one sitting. They don't go to the dentist. You know, I don't sit in a dental chair. There's plenty of guys like that. Full arch for them is a perfect treatment.
Yeah, it's a home run.
They get knocked out once. They get it done. And, you know, you get them into maintenance. And that's my next kind of soapbox when I get on it and I start, you know, pressuring them to come back for maintenance. But yeah, that's full arch. That's full arch gig. It's cool. Come by the office if you ever want to see it and see our workflow. And you're always welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
Always welcome to come check it out, how we do things.
I would like to see your workflow at some point if I can. Maybe this summer. Once I got 2 months left. Maybe this summer. That might work.
Totally. Yeah, we get a lot of residents, students through Perrier residents sometimes. You know, when I'm not going to get into, this is recorded, I'm not going to get into all our periodontist jokes. Opening up in the HR department.
We won't let them know. We won't let them know. What's these days, what are your favorite, what's your favorite procedure that you look forward to doing, like, in a week?
Definitely it.
Okay. So it's your favorite one. That's your favorite one that you look forward
one-off,
to?
One-off. Definitely one-off. It's okay. A common one in my practice these days, so that's probably why. I like doing it, and I do it frequently, so it's definitely fun. Because it's a very drastic before and after.
Yeah.
Take somebody that, you know, terrible dentition, and a week later, you know, after their recovery, I could take a picture, and it looked like night and day. In general, neck dissection is one of my favorite operations.
Okay.
Parotidectomy was one of my favorite operations. I don't do as many parotids anymore just because of the referral pattern. Most parotid tumors will end up in either PCP or dermatology offices, and they usually have their ENT referral pattern. So I just don't do as many parotids, nowhere near as many as I used to. Cancer, certainly still, you know, neck dissection is one of my favorite operations. Another thing that I never thought I would get into them as much as I'm into now is orthognathics. I come from a program that was historically not very orthognathic heavy. Usually in training, most orthognathic experience comes from private practice docs. You know, like Bellevue probably doesn't generate much orthognathics. So Kings County, the same. They didn't really generate much orthognathics. And we didn't have that many. When I was in fellowship, I had no idea that was going to happen. I came to Lenox Hill for head and neck fellowship.
Yeah.
And former chairman of NYU, actually, Stuart Super, was at Lenox Hill, and he had at the time a rotation. That's how I know a lot of the NYU guys, because during my fellow year, I met three NYU residents operating with Super, and then I stayed on for probably additional 3 years in practice.
I see.
Super was either in his late 70s or early 80s, and he had a very busy orthognathic practice. He was probably, at the time when I was there, because this was after his fellowship ended, he was probably still doing just under 100.
Wow.
He had the volume. So when I came to my
fellowship. That's some serious volume right there.
I mean, in his prime, he was easily in 300s. When he was in his prime, he was probably doing 350, if not more.
Third stories.
When I was there for fellowship, it was just like an additional like icing on the cake. This was just blessing. I'm here for cancer, and here's Stuart Super, who's like, hey, I don't want to cut these cases anymore. So it's you and the residents. So that was my Thursday.
Go do them.
Thursdays, I was doing them with NYU residents. And when I finished, he was like, you know, his business partner, one of the oral surgeons in the city, was like, you know, Steve, I think you need to give Dr. Super a hand. He's getting a little bit tired. By tired means he just want to sit in his chair. He saw all the pre-ops, he saw all the post-op, and there were occasions when I would cut my sign. I give him a lot of credit for this. So, you know, you've done IVR, I'm sure. And a lot of, you know, beginner residents in their beginning think that IVR is such a physical operation that requires a lot of force. And every now and then I'll cut my sign, and then the resident will struggle, and the super will get up. And, I mean, he has arthritis, and he has trouble walking up to the OR table, and his hand's already like a little deformed. His glove is not on all the way. And he'll grab that saw and he's like, he's done. It was like 2 seconds. He still had it. Even though he looked a little, you know, that he can't do it, he had it.
He still had it.
He still had it, yeah. And he would definitely school a resident like a 2 second osteotomy. So yeah, those were good times. And just, you know, from there, I just, you know, when I was in Hoffman's practice, he had a big gig with orthognathics. We were doing a good amount when I was there. I just kind of got into it. And I love doing the osteotomies, man. This was definitely one of my top five doing orthognathics. So still do that.
Right.
You know, I have a relationship with, you know, several orthodontists, friends, colleagues, and those cases are great. Those cases are fun. Certainly not like Dave Alfie in Texas, where he focuses his practice on orthognathics. Probably average about 20, 25 a year, so it's not a great volume, but it's something that I like to do.
It's pretty good. That's still pretty good.
And the cool cases, we've done some, you know, what kind of, every surgeon has a bucket list of things, and at some point I had a, you know, this, you know, kind of hots for this inverted L advancement, intraoral inverted L advancements. So I've done a whole bunch of those. Those were cool, you know, with VSP. Those are cool cases. Yeah, I mean, those are, you know, and the residents love them. Residents certainly love him.
Yeah.
Love orthognathics. I operate a lot now. I've almost fully, not quite fully yet, but nearly fully transitioned my OR practice to Nassau University, to NUMIC.
Oh, you're Nassau University. So do you work with NUMIC at all? Or?
So I'm not employed by the hospital. I'm a voluntary surgeon, but I would take a lot of my cases there. I'm probably like 85-90% now. Because when I was in Staten Island, obviously I would do most of my cases there.
Right.
I had a pretty heavy presence at Maimonides in Brooklyn. Now I'm kind of, you know, phasing out of all those spots and mainly trying to do everything in NUMIC.
Why are you phasing out?
It's just distance. I'm just not in Staten Island anymore. Brooklyn's far. Mm. I used to take call at Maimonides up until this past July. So I'm proud to say I haven't done a single trauma case since July. I joke around when I say proud to say, look, trauma has certainly a role in oral surgery. But as you get a little bit older, mature of a surgeon, I think you'll realize that trauma is not for you.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
You forget something. I mean, I come from a trauma, you know, Mecca. I come from Kings County Hospital. You know, in our days, it's all we did was trauma. But a lot of oral surgeons, especially oral surgery residents, say, we love doing trauma. We love doing trauma. And I say, you know, to like my younger self in residency, I would say, you love operating. Because as a inner city hospital resident, what's guaranteed on your plate is a trauma.
Exactly. Exactly.
And as you grow, you know, as you grow as a surgeon, you build your surgical practice.
Mm.
Now you have elective cases. Now you have your cancer or benign pathology, reconstruction, orthognathics, some TMJ. You start getting busy, you start getting reputation, you have those cases aligned.
Right.
If you had the choice, you would do the elective cases over trauma any day. Because trauma kicks your ass. You know, you're an add-on, you're on the weekend, you're in the evening, you know, you get bumped by a stroke code, or you get bumped by an appy, you know, now you're stuck there. You know, you don't want to do trauma. You know, that section's all inflamed and bloody, and it's not as fun to do a trauma case as to do an elective case. So we as residents or trainees, when we used to say, I love doing trauma. It's like, no, you love operating and all you get is trauma, you know, but this is kind of where I come from. Yeah. So, you know, I'm pretty happy not doing trauma because you know,
it's a great point.
Surgical schedule is filled with other things. I don't know. Maybe I'll miss it at some point, but I don't think I've done a mandible in, I don't know, probably at least 6 months. And at some point when I started, when I was like super aggressive, I started, my record was 22 mandibles in 1 month.
In 1 month?
I took call at 3 level 1 trauma centers and I just operated on everything. You know, this was my second or third month into practice. Over time, you know, I was the new guy that wanted to operate. Everybody who was on the call pool just kind of dumped things on me. So, you know, I just went to town and I've done my share of trauma. I'm proud to say that.
You're done.
I'm done. I don't have to do it.
Yeah, and it changes, kind of like you're saying. It's different times. And for you, you're in a different chapter, right? Because you own your own practice now. So it's a different type of mindset where you're trying to bring in certain cases, the elective cases. You have to get in that referral network, like you were talking about. It's a different referral network through the hospitals. You know, how many cases are you getting from taking call?
Exactly. And I don't have to take call anymore. You know, yeah. Thank God for, you know, very thankful to the NUMIC team. Their attendings have just been super welcoming. And, you know, they obviously take the call without expecting me to take, or my partner, you know, my like you know, to take. And that's great. You know, I'm very grateful for them to just taking care of that.
Who do you work with at NUMIC, right? You got Gerard Fisher there, right?
So Gerard is one of the junior guys.
Right.
But he's there. He's certainly a solid dude. We're blessed. You know, we overall have a very good group of residents. It's a small program, so that's a challenge. Sometimes I'm afraid to give them that volume because they have their own cases. They have their house cases. They have their trauma.
Yeah.
And whatever comes through clinic. And then it's, you know, my kind of habit where I came from in Staten Island, I had a full day block day every week. Even though I was a private practice surgeon, I was operating at an academic volume. I was doing about 120, 130 cases a year being private practice. So I came from that mindset. I certainly cut my numbers down by a lot. But even now, I have that fear of flooding them with cases because it's hard to have four residents. You know, they don't have a dual degree component. They only have the single degree one resident per year. There's always one on rotation. So it's three people.
Yeah.
You know, you take a chief into the OR, it's like you and the chief. Doable, but like if you're doing a head neck case, it's hard. You need another resident. You know, you pull out another resident, the clinic is now deficient. So hopefully those guys will grow. They had a prelim this year, very solid dude. And hopefully they'll have a prelim next year. That certainly helps the whole program out. That certainly helps the whole group.
It does.
Have an extra body, you know, we could, you know, have a prelim in running the clinic and we could pull out more residents into the OR. There's no ENT. So, you know, if we're doing a head neck case with ENT doing a flap for us, when there's a facial plastics guy, or even plastics doing a flap for us, you know, we're you know, our residents are running the show.
Mm.
So we need, you know, our resident at the donor side, we need our resident at the head. So we're stretching, you know, them thin, bringing those cases. I think 1 or 2 a month is probably
plenty.
Not for them. It's plenty.
Awesome.
I don't want to wear anybody out.
Oh, it'll definitely wear them out. Yeah, the one resident a year, that's tough over there. But adding on another body, that's going to go a long way for them. I love NUMIC. That was such a great program. I was looking at it. I interviewed with them. Yeah, that's a solid place. They got
it's
good
a
people.
Solid place. It's a solid place. I think it's probably one of the best private practice preparation. Mm. You know, there are four-year programs like Woodhull, unlimited dental alveolar, unlimited anesthesia, pretty limited OR experience. So like, it's like contrast, right? So NUMIC, I think the amount of dental alveolar they have is equivalent to one of the inner city single degree programs where there's like a ton of dental alveolar component. But I think NUMIC has enough from just local private practice surgeons, enough orthognathics where I think they're all coming out proficient.
And yeah.
Now, you know, that we do pathology there, a resident graduating at least having done 5 cancer cases per chief year. I think that, like we talked about earlier, they're not going to do head neck, but having done at least, you know, 5 malignancy cases, you know, some additional benign, being in the neck, you know, a little bit more frequently will make them a little bit more prepared just overall as a surgeon.
Yeah, and well-rounded. Absolutely.
So being, you know, the head neck training is a little bit different. You know, oral surgeons for decades did extraoral mandibles without an issue. But when we brought in head neck into our specialty, we start operating a little bit different. If you watch some of the newer grads operating now, and that stems to head neck guys, you know, you have your clean dissection, sharp dissection through everything. you see your platysma, you find your nerve, you get your vessels. Not that it's wrong, but, you know, the way I was taught in residency before that, head and neck, you know, just blunt dissect everything, you know, nerve test, you know, things are pretty bloody. You know, it's just a different approach. Not that it's a wrong approach, but it's a different approach. Now that you're starting to learn both, I think the residents are now starting to operate a little different. Now I'm starting to see non-head neck guys operate a little bit more like head neck guys. So that, I think, has been impact of just fellowship training head neck oral surgeons being present in more training programs across the country.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's so great. Yeah.
Has impact for sure. Speaking of free flaps and all this stuff is we did a pediatric free flap abroad.
A pediatric? What was that? What was that about?
Mission trip. So I'll start a little, you know, another thing that was unexpected for me is when I came with Dr. Hoffman, you know, when I joined Dr. Hoffman, he's been very heavily involved in charity care and surgical missions to South America. Oh, there goes my lights. Hey, Google, turn on lights in the MD office. I think things are programmed at 7 p.m. So Dr. Hoffman's been going to Colombia for probably like over 25 years now. And there are secondary mission trips. He goes to Ecuador. He's been to a lot of places. And when I joined him, it was kind of, you know, same concept as we start with mentorship, right? So I obviously got mentored and everything. And this was one of the things. And same concept of surgery being the easiest thing, still the easiest thing. Organizing those trips is a real challenge. You know, picking spot, where to go, what to bring, who to bring with you, what kind of equipment, what is the, you know, local hospital have in terms of infrastructure. So I've gotten introduced to that with him. And again, the man's brilliant and the stuff that he did and how he did, obviously learned on his mistakes over the past 25 years doing this. I learned a lot of it from him. And we've, you know, brought some patients to the States. That was also kind of his achievement. But I got involved with ORCA. I don't know if you know about ORCA. So it's an organization that stands for Reidential Aid Central America. The Reidential Aid dental implants, right? So those guys go to Guatemala, and the center that they have is just state-of-the-art dental school, digital equipment. Currently, I'm not going to get into too much history of ORCA, but currently they'll go and do, you know, 50, 60 arches of remote anchorage and load them immediately. So that's the primary goal of the mission. And I didn't get involved with them primarily because of that. You know, they have, you know, plenty of implant guys that could do this. And then I got involved by them coming across pathology cases. So they had this mission trip for implants and all these gringo doctors coming to do implants. And they were so grateful. And they're like, hey, you know, we have somebody with this jaw mass. And then my colleague, Caitlin Patel out of Minnesota, he was one of, you know, he was the first to go with them. And he did a case on a 12-year-old. You know, massive amyloblastoma resection, put a fibula in it. And then they had more cases and they're like, hey, maybe we need an extra set of hands. That's when they reached out to me. First time I went was a year ago. We did a case with Caitlin. We did a pretty massive, essentially hemimandibulectomy. It was, you know, disarticulation for big amyloblastoma. He did the flap. I did the ablation. It was a 22-year-old patient. I mean, we're talking about it. This is third, you know, this is outside of America doing a reflap. You know, I got into this with cleft. Not that cleft care is easy. I mean, those are, you know, very intricate surgeries. But in terms of medical management and post-op management, cleft care is a little bit
different.
Less tense and less anxiety provoking on us. Because as you know, free flap could go down, but the monitoring the whole night. So, you know, Caitlin did the first one with ORCA. We did the second with him. And then a 9-year-old came, and it's on my Instagram. You'll see a 9-year-old.
Oh, the one in the front. The one in the front. Yeah, I did see that.
Near mandible. Not the soccer ball size from Africa. That was a different one. This is a 9-year-old kid.
Okay.
Kid with anterior mandible amyloblastoma, and he is malnourished. The mom, you know, says he doesn't go to school anymore. Kids make fun of him. He can't speak anymore, and they were desperate, and they came to ORCA and they said, hey guys, can you help us? And Caitlin was unavailable for this case for some other reasons, and one of my surgeons that I work with here in New York is an ENT surgeon, Ofer Azoulay. This 9-year-old free flap in Guatemala is like, let's do it, let's fucking go. So we went last year in March, and the OR looks like my office over here. You know, I got one of the NSK handpieces to do the mandibulectomy. I mean, you know, anesthesia was there. They did a great job. You know, we intubated, did a big resection, offered did an amazing job. I want to shout out, you know, KLS a little bit. I don't know what things with promoting, but KLS stepped up. This was a nonprofit thing. They donated, you know, their services. They gave us plates. They gave, you know, the whole.
Oh, that's great.
We brought, you know, I brought a whole suitcase of stuff, you know, KLS instruments, put a fibula in him, a 9-year-old fibula. This is, you know, a lot of centers probably won't do it here.
Right, right.
One millimeter vessels, you know, all these concerns we had, you know, airway management, you know, how's the local hospital there? You know, we call it a hospital, but it's like a clinic, man. Like, it's, you know, there were one bed ICU, you know, it's like, but they did a fantastic job. They took care of the patient really well.
One bed?
One bed ICU. It's like a little, you know, the health systems are very different outside of this country. When we talk about hospitals, you being at NYU, man, there's like a 10-block stretch of hospitals. That's what you have in mind when you say word hospital. When I say hospital in Guatemala, it's a little, you know, you would call it more of a clinic than a hospital. One floor, portion of a floor in a building is a hospital, you know.
Oh.
But the docs are great. You know, they took, you know, great care of him. And I went back this year, a year later. He's doing great. You know, he healed very well. He's 9 after all. So I went to take the plate out. It was a metal plate. It wasn't a resorbable. So, you know, he's growing. So, you know, it's probably fair enough to remove the plate. I went, I checked on him, and he's doing great. And, you know, it's, again, giving you, like, the highlights of it. But
yeah,
what's behind it is, What am I used to using? So Hemoclips, a Ligasure, you know, a nice this instrument, a nice that instrument, you know, circuit flow. You think Guatemala has all that? You know, my anesthesiologist does, you know, this for me, that for me. You know, so this was a lot of organization, getting it all together. Orca certainly stepped up. They do have to pay for hospital there, for anesthesia care there. A lot of stuff we had to prepare and it was donated and we put things together.
It's gotta be expensive. Yeah, that's
why, you know, they're very heavy on their donations, and they kind of work year round raising funds for this. It's just overall great organization that, you know, they make this happen. So at this point, it's, you know, care from zygomatic implants to now we're able to do, you know, head and neck tumors.
Yeah,
this past trip, one of the Orca guys, Zach Brown, did a pediatric ankylosis. Pretty serious case to do abroad. You know, ankylosis cases are never easy. So he did an ankylosis release on the 8-year-old. So, you know, this was, you know, all Orca cases. And
that's
know.
Pretty good. And you said you were working with KLS. Have you seen the IPS plates that KLS is doing on the?
Yes. I mean, I would use something like this here.
Yeah.
Locally, you talk about the subperiosteal.
Yeah, not for Guatemala, of course, but for here, I'm curious your thoughts.
We actually did a sub. It wasn't a KLS sub, but we actually did a sub in Guatemala. I'm actually working on a paper with, you know, one of the, you know, huge names in oral surgery. I don't know if you know Vishy Brumad. He's in Arizona.
Okay, yeah.
Vishy is a giant of his own now, but in his younger days, he was Bob Marks' protege. He's a trained Bob Marks and Miami. He's certainly an implant king, head neck trained, single degree guy, head neck trained, practicing in Arizona, private practice. He's big on subperiosteals. So those we'll call, you know, patient specific PSI, subperiosteal implant. So putting a chapter for oral surgery clinics together should be out this summer.
That's exciting.
This is definitely a new, it's probably a wrong term to use. It's not a new thing to us. It's a reborn thing, because subperiosteal implants were done. And a lot of us, the younger guys, that we didn't experience this in training. I was like in that, you know, it's like a donut. There's like a hole. I was in like the middle. There was no subs done. And because nobody did subs when I was in training, we always thought of them as it's just bad treatment. You know, osteointegrated and osseous implants kind of saved the world. You know, subs were pre-osseointegrated. It's not true. Subs did very well. Subs always did very well. And why did they not take off? And why did they, you know, why did they lose popularity? It was 2 surgeries. It was very difficult to do. It was very difficult on the patient. You had to open, you know, the gingiva, raise the flaps, take compressions, close everything up, let it heal, come back. It wasn't easy. It wasn't the GP Peridon's level.
Yeah.
Even though now GP Peridon is do subs and remote anchorage and all that. But, you know, in the 90s, early 2000s, mostly only oral surgeons would do that. And they just kind of fell out of favor. Subs did well. And there's a lot of patients that are still walking around with subperiosteal implants from the 80s.
Mm.
So now with digital technology, they're making a comeback. And KLS is one of the companies that, you know, and I did their case number 10 in the States. I was one of the first guys in New York to do a maxillary sub with KLS. Since there have been other companies that are doing it, now we have several to compare to, and they have certain differences. I think designing a subperiosteal implant is a huge component of it. A design, you know, you can have not the best design of your orthognathic plate and it's still going to do its job. A faulty design on a subperiosteal implant, you could have major, you know, the dehiscence is a huge problem.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't design it properly, you know, especially in the mandible, you could have serious dehiscence. So yeah, these things are making a comeback. I don't think they will replace remote anchorage.
Mm.
I think subs still remain a kind of a bailout option, I think, in today's day and age. Definitely something to consider for maxillectomy defects with soft tissue reconstruction only. I actually have a cool case that I'm battling insurance on. I had a bone-only maxillectomy for a fibrosseous lesion. So we preserved the soft tissue, completely preserved the soft tissue. It was a bone-only maxillectomy. But that's a perfect case. The lady doesn't want a free flap. She doesn't want to talk about a fibula. Super anxious about surgery. And, you know, a KLS sub is a perfect treatment for her.
Perfect, yeah.
She has a soft tissue. She has no bone. She has no teeth. You know, put a sub and put teeth on. We actually have a design and ready to go. We're struggling with insurance a little bit.
Ah.
Those cases are, you know, interesting cases. And hopefully we'll have the paper out in June. This should be a really comprehensive overview. It should be a cool read.
I'm looking forward to that. I want to see that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll send you a copy once it's out.
That'd be great.
Yeah. The Vishy is the editor of clinics for this edition, and so you know he picked me to do a sub chapter with him.
That's awesome. Yeah, he picked the right person too. That's great.
Yeah, and we have a couple international guys because subs have been done in a recent decade or so, probably a little bit more abroad than here, just because things are a little bit more regulated here. So there are a couple of guys from overseas that are on the chapter with us, and they have some cool cases. The work those guys do is just like insane stuff that's done abroad. So we should have some cool pictures. We should have some cool cases in there. And
that's going to be awesome. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, cool. I'll make sure to send it to you. I mean, hopefully you're not like on vacation for like 6 weeks somewhere, MIA in the summertime. You'll read it once you're back in August.
Yeah, he's going to... He's going to bust my butt. So I start August 15th. I'm trying to go away. I want to go to Europe a little bit with my girlfriend. And first time seeing the world, really. So I haven't seen enough. So yeah, get away a little bit.
Catch up. You'll catch up. I have friends and colleagues who traveled the world because their parents took them. I come from a family that never happened.
Yeah.
So I'm catching up. You know, I learned how to ski this year. You know, at 39.
Just this year?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, just they didn't have that opportunity to do it as a kid and then training and all that. So now I'm catching up. Now I'm catching up with traveling the world. So, you know, you still got time.
That's true.
You know, just won't be able to take a month at a time. But, you know, it's fair, I think, you know, 2 weeks here and there.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you could probably do a 2 week trip once a year. Like, I wouldn't do 2 weeks every 3 months. You could do weekend trips, but I think 2 weeks once a year is a fair game. You know,
that sounds about right. Yeah.
No, I haven't been. It's on my list. But like, if you go to Japan, you can't go for 5 days to Japan. So you got to take some time off to do Japan.
Isn't it like a day to get there? So if you take a week off, yeah, it's 5 days.
There's a lot to see. And I think 5 days is not enough. You got to bite the bullet and take 2 weeks off to go to Japan. Like, just how I think.
Have you been to Japan? Is that your next trip?
No, it's not my next, but it's...
Can get the sushi.
It's on the list. Well, sushi in New York, I think, is you know, they'll give a good competition to sushi in Japan, I'm sure. But
you think so? I can see that.
I mean, we got some good stuff here.
We definitely do.
New York definitely has. I mean, I've been to a good amount of sushi spots, and not just in New York, but sushi in New York is pretty good, I think. we got some good chefs.
I love it here. I think it's excellent. I mean, I'm a little crazy. I'll go to the supermarket and grab some 30% off from Fairway, but that's...
Listen, they may not be, you know, as good as omakase, but sometimes, you know, like a spicy tuna roll from a supermarket, yeah. You know, during residency.
A little volcano roll.
Yeah. I've never done that during residency. No, it works. It works.
Helps you get by, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what's the deal with Jack? Are you going to be in one office or are you going to...
Just Melville. Just Melville. That's the deal.
Just Melville. Are you from Suffolk County?
Yeah, I'm from Smithtown. That's like 25 minutes away. So
to live in Suffolk County?
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm gonna buy my dad's house.
All right. That was going
to
be nice.
Yeah. I think it's going to be especially nice because growing up in Smithtown and then coming back to Smithtown after how many years, I'm hoping to get like that kind of home fulfillment where it's like back at home. I know the land, I know the house, I know the town. And that's, so I'm hoping to get that like fulfillment from that. You know, it's, I'm not looking for a big mansion or I just want a house. We could build it over time.
Yeah.
Keep it simple.
You're close enough to the city. You could, you know,
go out
to Fly Fish Club on a Saturday.
Exactly. Maybe Friday night, come into the city. Yeah. Yeah.
It's still doable. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, man. Hey, thanks for coming on tonight. I appreciate getting your insight.
For sure, man. We could sit here and talk for hours, but yeah, I mean, I didn't realize how time flew by. But yeah, it was good chatting, man.
It's been a great chat, and we'll do this again.
We should definitely hang out.
Yeah, man.
Hang out, drag out Chafkin, county reunion.
I can't get him out. I don't know what's... We keep talking about making plans, and we never make them.
That's, you know, probably part of running a multi-location practice, but yeah. Tell him to check out the episode and tell him, you know, we talked about you and we said we got to drag you out for dinner.
I'll text him right now. Yeah, we'll get him to Fly Fish Club. We'll get some good omakase. It'll be a good time.
Sounds like a plan, man. Sounds like a plan.
All right, Doug. Come
to meeting in person and stop by the office, reach out. You know, would love to hear from you more.
I'll be talking to you this summer. I want to come through this summer. See you on a nice day where you got a case or two going. But you're all an expat way.
Sounds like a plan, man.
All right. You have a good night. I got to go talk to a resident. Looks like we got an orbital floor. But good stuff.
Good luck with trauma.
Here it comes. Right.
It's still fun. And residency is still fun. You don't have to worry about being an add-on. You're in the hospital anyways.
Sure. We're here. It's right here.
Have fun with it, man.
All right, Dodgers, you have a good night. Thanks again.
Take care, Brandon. Right. Be well.